Good. Om Sahana Vavatu, Sahanao Bhunaktu, Sahavirdyan Karava Vahai, Tejasvi Navadhi Tamastu Mavid Vishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Good. Welcome back. We continue our study of chapter 4. We have, I think, a nice section of the text to see today. We'll begin, as always, with some chanting. Repeat after me, starting with verse 7. Yada yada hi dharmasya, yada yada hi glanir bhavati bharata, glanir bhavati. Abhyutthanam adharmasya abhyutthanam tadatmanam srijamyaham tadatmanam paritranaya sadhunam paritranaya vinashaya cha duskritam vinashaya dharma samsthapanarthaya dharma samsthap Sambhavami yuge yuge, sambhavami yuge. Janma karma cha me divyam, janma karma cha me. Evam yo veti tattvatah, evam yo veti. Tyaktva deham punar janma, tyaktva deham. Naiti mameti sorjuna, naiti mameti sor. Vitaraga bhaya krodha vitaraga manmaya mam upashrutah manmaya mam bahavo jnana tapasa bahavo jnana bhuta madbhava magatah bhuta madbhava ye yatha mam prapadhyante ye yatha mam Tamstataiva bhajamyaham, tamstataiva bhajam. Mama vartmanu vartante, mama vart. Manusha parta sarvashaha, manusha parta. Kangshanta karmanam siddhim, kangshanta karmana. Yajanta hiha devataha, yajanta hiha devataha. Kshipram hi manushe loke, kshipram siddhir bhavati karmaja, siddhir chatur varnyam maya srishtam, chatur varnyam gunakarma vibhagashaha, gunakarma tasya kartaram apimam, tasya kartar. Vidyakartaram avyayam, vidyakartar. Namam karmani limpanti, namam karman. Name karma phale spraha, name karma. Iti mam yo bhijanati, iti mam yo. Karma bhirna sabadhyate, karma bhir. Evam jnatva kritam karma, evam jnatva purvarapi mumukshubihi, purvarapi mumukuru karmaiva tasmatvam, kuru karmaiva tasmatvam, purvai purvataram kritam, purvai purvakritam.
Very good. So, we were... We had seen the first half of verse 11 in our prior class. We'll pick it up there. The current topic is forms of prayer, invoking Bhagavan's blessings. Of course, the chapter opened with Bhagavan as Avatara. We had a long discussion on Avatara, Vada. Now we move on to other topics in the chapter. Here, talking about forms of prayer. And we just began this verse, so let's return to the beginning. And there's a very interesting
observation about this current verse, verse 11. Let's return to that point. Ye yatamam prapadyante, ye yatamam tam sataiva bhajamyaham, tam sataiva bhajam. Mama vartmanu vartante, mama vartmanu vart. Manusha parta sarvashaha, manusha parta. This is a very interesting verse, I think. Interesting in the sense that it reveals something very significant and central to the Hindu tradition. I'll show you what I mean. We began the first part of the verse in a prior class, ye yata mam yata, in the manner in which ye, some people, mam prapadyante, prapadyante seek, mam, me, Sri Krishna speaking. The manner in which some people, the manner in which people seek me, tan, to them, tata eva, in that same manner, bhajami aham, I serve them, aham, I bhajami, and I commented in our last class that this verb bhaj doesn't only mean to worship. In fact, it has some very different meanings. You know, we're most familiar with that root bhaj in a sense of bhajans, bhajana. Bhakti comes from that same root, bhaj, and it often means to worship. But do you know bhajana also means to divide? Bhakti, but vibhakti, those of you who know a little Sanskrit or Hindi, bhakti, devotion, but vibhakti, separation. So bhaj can also mean to separate or to divide, to apportion, just to show you that we have to be a little careful about the language. So here, bhajami. Because if you don't understand, you think, aham bhajami, Lord Krishna is saying, I worship them. Do you think that's what he's saying? I worship them? Or I divide them? So those are two meanings of bhaj. To worship is one meaning. A second meaning is to divide, but neither one of those give the right meaning. So there's a third meaning. There are several other meanings. And just to remind you that just as when you look up a word in Webster's dictionary, you have multiple definitions. The same is true in Sanskrit. So here, bhaj sevayam is the classical definition, which means bhaj here is in a sense of service. I serve them. Not I worship them, not I divide them, but rather I serve them. Now to get the full meaning of that first half. According to the manner in which people seek me, prapadyante, accordingly I serve them. Which, as we discussed at the end of the prior class, that according to our prayers, Bhagavan will bless us. Does it mean that we get exactly what we pray for? Certainly not. But it does mean that according to the nature of our prayer, we are blessed. So if you remember at the end of the class that Mandababa story, Mandababa begging for a penny, how silly that was. In the same way, if our prayers are very naive and childish, the result of our prayer will be accordingly. If our prayers are very intimate and deep and strongly connected to Bhagavan, then again, according to the nature of our prayer, that will be the manner in which we're blessed. And the second half, we saw that in the prior class, so we'll go on to the second half here. Mama vartma anuvartante manushyaha partha sarvashaha partha o arjuna. Manushyaha, people. People, anuvartante, they follow. Mama vartma, nice expression, my path. Mama vartma, anuvartante, manushyaha. People follow my path, sarvashaha, in all ways, in all manners. What do you mean by my path? It really means a path to God. A path to Sri Krishna in particular, but a path to Bhagavan, to God in general. So people approach, I'll paraphrase now, people approach me, people approach God in all various manners. So you can see the connection to the first part. According to the nature of their prayers, they are blessed, which means different people have different kinds of prayers, not only praying for different things, but as we commented, prayers of different levels of maturity, different levels of understanding. Some people, in fact, we're going to see, I think in chapter 7 or 9, we're going to see a famous verse that says, you know, that people who pray are motivated for four different reasons. There are those people who only pray at times of disaster, catastrophe, apat. So only when things are going very badly, then and then only they pray, oh God, save me. This is one kind of prayer. Then another kind of prayer is a more worldly prayer. Oh God, please give me this, please give me that, please help me with this. Yay day do, yay be day do. These kinds of prayers. The shopping list prayer. So that's another kind of prayer. Then there's yet a more mature kind of prayer where people pray, hey Bhagavan, may I know you truly. Beautiful prayer. Hey Bhagavan, reveal yourself to me. Help me understand who you are and what this world is about, what my life is about. Please bless me with spiritual growth. Is that third category of prayer. And then the fourth category is the prayer of the enlightened person. And a prayer of an enlightened person is very simple. In English, we'd say, thank you. Two words. That's the entire prayer. Thank you. That's a prayer of an enlightened person. So the point is that according to the nature of the person praying, that will determine the nature of their prayer. And then according to the nature of their prayer, they're blessed. Which means here we're acknowledging people of different levels, of different orientations in their religious and spiritual life. And that is carried over into the second half. Different people with different orientations and different levels of maturity approaching God, sarvashaha, in all different ways. Mama vartma anuvartante manushaha. People approach me, Sri Krishna says, in a whole variety of ways. Now, what's so significant about this, some of you will take this for granted. In fact, almost all of you raised in India will take this for granted because, of course, people follow Bhagavan in different ways, different paths, using different prayers, different spiritual traditions, different sampradayas is the word that we'll often use, different religious traditions. There are Vaishnavas who worship Vishnu, Shaivas who worship Shiva, Shaktas who worship Devi, Goddess, etc. And again, those of you raised in India, you may take this for granted, but perhaps you've come to understand that this is not common in world culture. Most religions take a markedly different approach to this. And the Hindu approach is, whatever works for you is fine. Back in the 1960s, kind of the hippie culture in this country, back in the 60s, there was an expression that was in common in those days. And I think it came into one of the pop songs in those days. And the expression was, different strokes for different folks. How is that? Very 1960s. Different strokes for different folks. Which means what works for one person won't necessarily work for another. Now, that stands to reason. That's true in all areas of life. You notice when you look around here, no two people are wearing the same kind of dress. Everyone dresses differently according to how they like to dress. Everyone has different preferences when it comes to food, when it comes to anything in life, different strokes for different folks. But consider this. If it's true that we all have different inclinations and disinclinations, which are very fundamental to our personalities, wouldn't that also be true, necessarily be true, when it comes to religious and spiritual life? Of course. How could it not be true in religious and spiritual life? but reflect for just a moment on how many other religions aren't very good at accommodating the individual inclinations and disinclinations of various people. Most religious traditions have like one way of worshiping God, one concept of who that God is, and they're very, compared to the Hindu tradition, much more narrow and focused, and much more uniformity, which leads to a small problem for Hinduism, a small problem, because it's not a problem for Hindus. It's a problem when non-Hindus try to understand Hinduism. They're baffled. What do you, first of all, you come to the altar, and then they'll say, what do you mean that Hindus don't really pray to statues? What do you have on your altar? So confusion begins. And then you say, and Hindus pray to one God. What do you mean, one God? One, two, three, four. Counting on it. It leads to a lot of confusion. To be honest, the Hindu tradition is far more complex than other religious traditions, which are kind of more focused, more narrow, more defined by a set of doctrines and dogmas, which is very different than the Hindu tradition. And many of you, some of you will refer to Hinduism almost as an umbrella under which many different traditions and forms of worship and forms of prayer, many different traditions included under that umbrella of Hinduism. Well, how clearly that's brought out in this particular verse. Manushyaha, people, mama vartma anuvartante, people seek me sarvashaha, in all ways, in a variety of ways. Which leads, just one last comment here, we'll move on, which leads to a very beautiful perspective for Hindus, that is, a Hindu will completely respect the religious pursuits of a non-Hindu. Why? Sarvashaha, in all ways. People approach me in all ways. Even if you wanted to take this in a very, very sectarian way. You know, some Hindus can be sectarian. And then when Sri Krishna says mom, it means mom. It means me. Mom is the Sanskrit pronoun to me. So, a sectarian Vaishnava might take this as people seek, not God in general, people seek Krishna in all ways. So that would be a more sectarian reading of this, and some people will give it that meaning. But the interesting consequence is, even if you give it a sectarian reading, people seek Krishna, sarvashaha, in all ways, which means Christians seek Krishna. This would be the sectarian interpretation. Christians are actually seeking Krishna. Muslims are actually seeking Krishna. Jews, etc., Parsis, whoever they are, they're all actually seeking Krishna. And if we define Krishna a little bit more broadly as God, absolutely, no one would debate that. So very beautiful how this verse brings out this breadth of vision of Hinduism, which appears to be unique among world religions. All right, we'll continue. Further about the nature of prayer. Kangshanta karmanam siddhim, kangshanta karmanam yajanta hiha devataha, yajanta hiha deva. Chipram hi manushe loke, chipram hi manushe. Siddhir bhavati karmaja, siddhir bhavati. So, given the fact that there are all kinds of people in the world, certainly there are a handful of people who are very pious and very spiritual, but would you agree with me that the extremely pious spiritual people are in the minority? I think we have to admit that. Which means most people are worldly in their orientation. And by worldly, we mean they want to achieve a lot of things in worldly life. Nothing wrong with that. It just means that's what they're, what is your number one priority? For a handful of people, the number one priority is spiritual growth. Excellent. But for the majority of people, we admit that the number one priority is worldly enjoyment, success in a worldly sense. Can a worldly person be religious? Absolutely. In fact, most of them are. When we say that worldly success is their number one priority, it doesn't mean that such people are ungodly or atheists. In fact, these are people who will incorporate religious practices into their pursuit of worldly goals. We've had this discussion in several other contexts. This is especially true in ancient India. It's true even today. But in ancient India, today, it's true when people pray that shopping list prayer. That's a nice expression, isn't it? Very, very vivid. That shopping list prayer. Oh God, please give me this. Please help me with this. Please, this thing. Shopping list prayer. So, in someone who has such a prayer, is their prayer an expression of intimacy with God, or is their prayer seeking God's help for the sake of them fulfilling their worldly desires? Obviously, it's the latter. This is not to criticize that form of prayer, but to observe it for what it is. You're seeking, pardon me for saying this, but someone who prays, "Hey Bhagavan, please make sure that my business is more successful in this year." There's no harm in such a prayer, but what that prayer does is that prayer makes God your business partner, right? that's what it comes down to. Hey God, please make my business prosper. So you want a business partner. Nothing wrong in it, but it certainly is a limited perspective. If you recognize that you're praying to the God of the cosmos, you're not talking to your uncle who has some money. If you go and seek the help of an uncle who happens to have some money, who can lend you something so you can build up your business, that's one thing. But the God of the universe is not like your wealthy uncle. That's the point here. So we recognize then that many times people invite God's help, Bhagavan's help, for the sake of fulfilling their worldly goals. And again, we're not saying that this is wrong, but we could say that it's a less mature approach to religion and spiritual life. Not wrong, certainly not wrong, but definitely less mature. Okay, enough said. This is true in modern times and absolutely was true in ancient times. In ancient times, it was prevalent, in fact, in the great emphasis on rituals in ancient India, as most of you know very well. Tremendous emphasis. And sometimes people will complain today, "Oh, Swamiji, it's just all ritual and ritual and ritual." You have no idea. In ancient times, it was vastly more ritualistic than what we see today. Even in the most pious families. So in the most pious families, you can see evidence of that ritualism, but it's nothing compared to the level of ritualism in ancient times. For example, in every home, there would be a ritual fire, which was kept burning all the time, rekindled twice a day for your morning and evening Agnihotra. How many of you do morning and evening Agnihotra? Have any? never for almost everyone in modern times. But in ancient times, these were minimum requirements. Was a complex fire ritual in your home twice a day, in addition to so many other rituals. And the purpose of all these rituals was what? By and large, all of the rituals were meant for reaching worldly goals. The rituals had specific objects in mind. For example, that Dwikala Agnihotra, the twice daily Agnihotra, fire ritual in the home, was meant to bless the home with prosperity and health, which is a worldly goal, a very desirable goal, but definitely a worldly goal. And that's what's being discussed in this verse. Such rituals and such people performing those rituals, those people who are kangshantaha, who are desiring. What do they desire? Karmanam siddhim. They desire siddhi, success. Success in their karma. And here, karma means specifically rituals. That's the context. And as I've mentioned before, if you were studying the Veda, the word karma, when used in the Veda, almost always means ritual. Be ready for that. Vaidika karma, Vedic karma means Vedic rituals. So here, karmanam siddhim, success in their rituals, kangshantaha, people who want their rituals to be successful, what do they do? Yajante, the A drops due to some grammar rules. Yajante, they worship devataha, they worship the gods. They worship the gods. Not unlike in modern times, if you need, the typical Hindu, if you need financial help, you worship goddess Lakshmi. If you have some problem or obstacle in your life, you might worship or say a prayer to Ganesha, Ganapati. And if you want some wisdom or knowledge, goddess Saraswati, etc. We have this tradition. So in ancient times, it was no different. According to what you wanted to accomplish, you would do a particular ritual to a particular devata, a particular god or form of god. But it was done for the sake of worldly accomplishments. And it was done iha, here in the world. And what does Sri Krishna have to say? Does Sri Krishna criticize this? We already admitted it's not wrong, so therefore it shouldn't be subject to criticism, and he doesn't criticize. He says, he indeed, manushe loke, in this world of people, in this world, kshipram, quickly, siddhi bhavati, quickly success happens, success is born, karmaja, born of those rituals. He says very quickly, people who are performing those rituals, worshiping the deities for the sake of particular worldly goals, Sri Krishna says, hey, they're blessed. Not only are they blessed, kshipram, quickly, they receive the results of their prayers, of their rituals. By the way, the word quickly is a matter of, it's relative. So, for example, quickly in this country, when you say when you're on the phone, I'll be back in a moment. And in this country, a moment generally means 10, 20 seconds, 30 seconds, right? In India, a moment can mean many things. Sorry, but but now watch this. When Sri Krishna says, in a moment, the God of the cosmos, the God who sees cycles of creation coming and going, when he says, in a moment, what does that mean? Can I share with you? This is a silly story. I hope I can if I can remember it properly, you'll enjoy it. I haven't told this for years, but it's a perfect story for this. There was a fellow walking in a park in a very prayerful mood, and this person thinks, I wonder if God can hear me. So he says out loud, God, can you hear me? And to his great surprise, he gets an answer, yes. I can hear you. And this man is just amazed. God can hear me. And then he goes on thinking, this is my great opportunity. I have God's attention. I should definitely ask God for something. And definitely, since I'm talking to the God of the cosmos, I shouldn't ask for anything small. I should ask for something significant. And so the man says, God, you are the God of the universe. You can give me anything. For you, God, you know, $1 million is like a penny. So God, can you give me $1 million? And he says, yes. Wow. He's going to give me. And then, actually, I don't remember the story. I have to wing it a little bit here. I'll try to make it work. It's probably been 3-4 years since I've told this, so it's gone. But let me try to recover the last part of it. It's always embarrassing to start a story and not know how it goes. Anyway, I'll have to make it up a little bit. And so here's he says, God, when will you give me this $1 million? Now watch the logic. You know, to God of the cosmos, a $1 million is like a penny, and to the God of the cosmos, a million years is like a moment. So, God, when will you give me that $1 million? God says, in a few moments. That's not the way it goes, but it sort of ends with that kind of idea. The connection, of course, is that a moment is relative. Kshipram, he says, in a moment our prayers are answered. That moment could be tomorrow. That moment could be next year. That moment could be in our next life. What is a moment? It's all relative, so we want to bear that in mind. So instead of criticizing the use of rituals for reaching worldly goals, Sri Krishna does not criticize. In fact, he kind of praises it by saying, Kshipram Siddhir Bhavati Karmajaya. He says, very quickly, you will receive those results. And with that verse, we come to the end of that discussion on prayer. Now we return to the central theme of this chapter. Remember the title of this chapter? A little complicated title. Jnana Karma Sannyasa Yoga. Since it's kind of central to what we're about to do, let me just remind you of the meaning of that complicated title. So the general theme is karma yoga, but the exact title of this chapter is not karma yoga, but karma sannyasa. Sannyasa means renunciation. But if you wonder what is the connection between karma yoga and karma sannyasa, from our prior studies, hopefully you could answer that question. One aspect of karma yoga is karma sannyasa. What does that mean? To say that an aspect of karma yoga is karma sannyasa. Karma sannyasa, let me fill it in for you. Karma phala sannyasa, renunciation of the fruits of action, which means when you act not with attachment for the results of the action. That was a central theme of karma yoga we discussed before. If you act with the expectation that I must get the result I seek, my happiness depends on getting this result, it better happen. Of course, that kind of attitude is a setup for misery in life because things rarely turn out the way we hope they will. So here, karma sannyasa is the opposite of that. It means to do the action recognizing that you are not in control of the results. You do the action, the results are in God's hands, so to speak. So therefore, you know well enough not to be so attached to the results because you may not get the results you expect. You can, at best, you can do the correct action, but you know that the results could be other than what you hope to achieve. This is what the term karma sannyasa means, renunciation of action, in the sense of renunciation of the fruits of those actions. And how does that renunciation take place? Through jnana, knowledge or wisdom. Through your understanding of who is God as karma phala data. We have to go back to that. So what kind of knowledge are we talking about? Knowledge of Ishvara, knowledge of God as karma phala data, as the giver of the results of all actions. This is what we understand. You are not the author of the results. You are the author of the action. Remember, back in chapter 2, karmanye vadikadaste ma paleshu kadachana. Next line, ma karma pala hetu bhuhu. Don't think that you are in charge of the results. Don't think that you are the author of the results, because definitely Ishvara, God, is the karma phala data, is the giver of the fruits of actions. With this knowledge, our attitude towards all actions is transformed. There's a kind of sannyasa or renunciation that takes place. And again, it's not a renunciation of someone who renounces the world and lives a life of a monk. This is a renunciation in terms of attitude, where you recognize that I am not in control of the results of actions. It's not in my hands. I relinquish that full sense of control over my life. That's what we mean by jnana, karma, sannyasa. And this is what's going to be brought out in the next sequence of verses. In spite of the fact that this next verse actually begins, the first half of the next verse is a little bit of an aside. You know, it's not uncommon. Remember, what we're reading is a dialogue between Sri Krishna and Arjuna. When you're talking, is it like you're following an outline when you talk to a friend? Or do you sometimes go on little diversions? You know, even I do that, every teacher also does that. And here we have a little bit of diversion at the beginning of the verse. Let's proceed. Chatur Varnyam Maya Srishtam, Chatur Varnyam Maya. Guna karma vibhagashah, guna karma vibhagashah, tasya kartaram apimam, tasya kartaram, vidya kartaram avyayam, vidya kartaram. Just to make the connection, look at the second half of the verse. Tasya kartaram apimam, mam, me. I am the kartaram. I am the doer. I am the creator of the world. We'll see it in the first half. I am the one who created the world. Kartaram api mam. Api. Even though I am the creator of the world, vidhi, please understand, akartaram mam. Please understand that I am not the creator. Even though I am the creator of the world, please understand, akartaram, that I didn't do anything. Huh? Sri Krishna says, even though I am the creator of the world, I really didn't do anything. Even Sri Krishna understands this principle. Even Sri Krishna understands that what is happening is the unfoldment of karma. For example, and speaking specifically, actually, as long as we're into it, let's take this up. Then we have to take that little diversion at the beginning of the verse. So this language looks very confusing and paradoxical. So it says, tasya, for that, for the creation of the world, actually, chatur varanyam maya srishtam, the four, we'll just see that briefly, the four categories of people, referring to the four so-called castes, we're going to talk about that, maya srishtam, were created by me. the four categories of people, the four castes, maya srishtam, were created by me. Guna karma vibhagashaha, according to their qualities and actions. We'll come back and talk about that. Tasya, of them, of those four groups of people, kartaram mam, I am the creator. I am the creator of those four categories of people. Api kartaram mam, even though I am the creator of those four categories of people, vidhi, please understand, akartaram, that I didn't do anything. Why? Avyayam, I am unchanging. Now, it looks like a paradox. He says, I am the creator of these four categories of people, but I don't do anything. It looks like a paradox, and what it refers to is the fact that there are two levels going on here, two perspectives that are being put side by side in the same verse. From a worldly perspective, of course, the world is created, the world has a creator. But there's another perspective. The absolute perspective. And I guess that let's get these two perspectives, then I want to come back and talk about this four categories, the four so-called castes. So how do we resolve this? What is Sri Krishna teaching us? Something that he's already taught in prior chapters. Previously, he said to Arjuna, Arjuna, you don't really do anything. What does it mean to say that a human being truly is a non-doer of action, actionless? And this is a topic that's going to come big time, not only here in chapter 4, but our next chapter, chapter 5. We're going to be talking a lot about actionless action. And if there's anything that sounds like a paradox, that certainly does. What do you mean by actionless action? So let's take it with regard to the individual person. A normal person is definitely an agent of action. I did it. Except for little children, when there's a lamp that's been broken, then what do they say? I didn't do it. They know they did it. They claim they didn't do it. But the point is, I did it. I didn't do it. I am the agent of action. This is the most common perspective. But then these teachings of Vedanta, these very profound teachings of Vedanta, lead us to a second level of understanding. At a worldly level, absolutely, you are an agent of action, without question. But there's another level or perspective. And we've discussed, starting in chapter 2, we've discussed that behind your mind is a conscious person. And the conscious person I'm talking about is not a concept. The conscious person I'm talking about is you, the one who knows what's happening in your mind right now. Your mind is busily doing whatever it's doing. Hopefully it's thinking about this class and nothing else. We don't know. I have no way of knowing. In either event, whatever your mind is engaged in right now, it's known by you. It's known to you. You are the conscious observer. You are the awareful witness of the activities of your mind. One of the many activities of your mind is decision-making and willful action. For example, there was a decision made to come for class this morning. You could have done many other things. You chose to come for class. So a decision was taken to come here for class in the morning. And willful action, you got into the car and you came here. So decision making and willful action occur in your mind, correct? They can't occur anywhere else. They occur in your mind. And everything that happens in your mind, all the activities in your mind are known to you, the conscious observer, the awareful witness, which means you, the conscious observer, did not decide to come. Your mind decided to come. you, the awareful witness, did not engage in the willful action of getting into your car and coming here. Your mind was involved in all that activity. This is a radically different perspective. We would call this an ultimate perspective, an absolute perspective. Paramartika is a term we use in Sanskrit. We distinguish between vyavaharika and paramartika. Vyavaharika, worldly. Paramartika, in reality. Absolute reality. So in a worldly sense, absolutely, you decided to come to class and you made the willful action of getting in the car and coming here. That's at one level. But from another level, with regard to your essential nature as Satchidananda Atma, as that conscious, unborn, uncreated, unchanging conscious being, which is your essential nature, at that level, you made no decision, you made no deliberate action. So these are the two levels. If that applies to you and me, could that not also apply to Bhagavan, to God? And that's what Sri Krishna is saying here. He says, even though I created these four categories of people, really speaking, akartaram, I am not an agent of action. I am indeed avyayam, unchanging. And to make this a little bit more clear, how about if we understand, get a little more language up here on the board. From this, let me put all these words, I've been using a lot of Sanskrit terminology, let me put a little bit of on the board. Vyavaharika means just worldly standpoint. And Paramartika means this absolute standpoint. So from this worldly standpoint, we understand that you are a jiva. You are a living person. You have a body, you have a mind, you have senses. You have the decision-making faculty. And you have the ability for deliberate, willful action. On the other hand, your essential nature is Satchidananda Atma, that conscious being, which is the consciousness behind your mind, the awareful witness of the decision-making process that goes on in your mind, and the deliberate action, which is directed by mind. In fact, not just mind, neurons. It's all part of this powerful brain that we've been blessed with is all engaged in that action. But whatever are the actions of that mind, they are known to you, the conscious observer. They are witnessed by you. You are that Atma, you are that Jiva. That's at that absolute level. Now, suppose we take this. This is, I guess philosophers would call this the microcosmic view, the individual view. In Sanskrit, we call vyashti, individual. Suppose we widen our view to the macrocosmic view. In Sanskrit, we call samashti. Or simply put, instead of talking about the individual, suppose we talk about Ishvara, God. I use the term God loosely here. So Ishvara, the one who Sri Krishna says, Chatur Varanyam Maya Srishtva, I am the one who created these four categories of people. That is to say, I'm the one who created the universe with these four categories of people. I am that Ishvara, that creator, sustainer, destroyer. If we want to add all that kind of language, the Srishtikarta, creator, Stiti Karta, sustainer, Upasamhara Karta, the one who receives the universe at the end of time, the so-called destroyer, that one is Ishvara, and Sri Krishna admits, that is me. But then he says, even though I am the creator, he says, even in spite of that, I don't do anything. Akartaram. What does it mean, I don't do anything? There's a second perspective on Ishvara. for that second perspective on Ishvara, we're less likely to use this word Atma, much more likely to use this word Brahman. Of course, ultimately they're the same, but that's another topic. But the point is just as underlying your worldly existence as an individual person, there's an absolute reality which does not participate in action. Reveals action, but doesn't participate in action. In the same way, from a worldly standpoint, there is a source of the universe, there is an intelligent creator for all, but that's at this worldly perspective. Underlying that worldly perspective is an absolute perspective, which says that there is an unchanging reality because of which even Ishvara exists. And with regard to that unchanging reality that we call Brahman, Sri Krishna says, Akartaram, I am not an agent of action. I am avyayam, unchanging, undecaying. Immutable is a translation they often use for that word. So you can see the parallel structure here. Oops. And this is what's going to be brought out, not only in this verse, but in the next couple of verses as well. Here, Sri Krishna is presenting himself as a model. By understanding these two levels about Sri Krishna, who speaks as Ishvara, the God of the universe. So when Sri Krishna says, even though I created the world, even then, really speaking, I don't do anything at all. This becomes a model then for us. Because to understand Ishvara is to understand ourselves. These are all related. Ultimately, the ultimate truth of Vedanta, which we're not even going to hint at today, well, we are going to hint right here. Vedanta is all about that equal sign. In a manner of speaking, the equality, the identity of Atma and Brahman is the ultimate teaching of Vedanta. This is not the time or place for any further discussion. But just to be very clear, and then we're going to come back to the class, that what we're going to see for several verses is Sri Krishna saying, I am the creator, but I didn't do anything. Talking about these two levels. And Sri Krishna is referring to himself from these two perspectives so that we can understand these two perspectives about ourselves. And really speaking, only when we understand these two perspectives of Ishvara, only then will we really understand, fully understand, these two perspectives about ourselves. So this is where the text is going. So, and that's the second half of the verse, and we'll pick that up in the next verse. But you notice that I skipped over the beginning of the verse, which is a little bit of an aside, but it's an important aside, extremely important. Chatur Varanyam Maya Srishtam. Maya, by me, Srishtam was created. Chatur Varanyam, the four Varanas, the four so-called castes. Brahmana, Kshatriya, Vaishya, Shudra, these four castes. He says that they were created by me. Now, we all know what a horrible burden casteism has been on Indian culture. Absolutely a horrible burden. And then Sri Krishna says, it's my fault. What? So let's be very clear. It's not his fault, because according to Sri Krishna, he says, I created these four groups, guna, karma, vibhagashaha. Vibhagashaha, according to divisions, according to what kinds of divisions, according to divisions of guna, quality, and karma, action, behavior. That's not our modern concept of caste. The traditional concept of caste is the family you're born into. Not guna and karma, janma. Notice Sri Krishna does not say janmashaha, according to their birth, I created these four categories of people. He doesn't say according to their birth. He does say according to their qualities, guna, and according to their behavior, karma, I create these four categories of people. What a shame that the caste system has been so horribly misunderstood and perverted. And yeah, this is not a... I don't think we're going to go deeply into this. We could talk about this for hours, no doubt, to trace how the caste system was perverted by some self-interested people. It was turned into a mechanism to control people for the advantage of a few. I don't think we should go into it in great detail. But just to observe here that there's no support for the concept of caste determined by birth. There is support for this idea. By the way, the word caste is actually a misnomer. The word caste has so many connotations associated with it. The term used here is varna. Varna simply means group. Now, when you say group, you don't mean there's no sense of higher or lower. The term varna doesn't allow for that kind of interpretation of higher or lower. They're just simply four groups. But we come along and we insert this word caste. And as soon as we do that, we've got this nice structure. The Brahmins are up on the top. The Shudras are at the bottom. And you know, there's one category below that. The so-called outcasts, mlechas, the ones like me who were not born in any one of the four castes. So we fall off the chart. We don't even make it onto this fourfold category. All right. So just to make this point really vividly, this problem with the word caste. Do some of you know of what origin the word caste is? Obviously, it's not Sanskrit, not Hindi, not any Indian language. It happens to be Portuguese. And it happened from when the, 400 years ago when Portuguese settlers came to the West Coast, and I think East Coast also they came and had their places. So these Portuguese settlers, the problem, and I don't want to go deeply into this, but maybe some missionaries and, they interpret Hindu culture through their own lens, through their own perspective. They saw the four groups of people. They did see, absolutely, the Portuguese settlers absolutely saw the so-called pecking order. This was the distortion of the caste system. The Varna system, Chatur Varna, let me call it correctly, Chatur Varna system, the system of four groups. But by the time the Portuguese came, the four groups had been stratified. Brahmins were on top, Shudras were on the bottom. Not only had it been stratified, but it was fixed by birth. Is any of that justified by scripture? Not by Bhagavad Gita. And if we wanted to talk about this further, we would find even in the Veda, you'll find no support for the stratification and for it being by birth. No support. We know it. We know religions get abused by the followers of that religion. That happens all the time. So Christians turn into missionaries and what was it? The crusaders. Same way, Muslims turn into terrorists. This is not justified by the religion. Islam does not justify terrorism. Christianity does not justify conquest. But followers of the religion will twist the doctrines of the religion around for their own purposes, for their own agendas. You know how that happens. It happens in all organizations and in all structures among all people, and Hindus were not immune. So it happened to Hinduism, where this caste system was distorted. So four groups, guna, karma, vibhaga, shaha. We'll just stay on this verse because I'd like to share with you how Shankaracharya explains this guna karma vibhagasha according to divisions of guna, quality, and karma, behavior. And Sri Shankara, in his commentary on this verse, gets very specific about how we can understand these four castes. Let me stop using that. I just criticize the use of that word, but it shows how deeply programmed it is into our heads. If only we could remove the word caste with all of its negative connotation and substitute the word chaturvarna, four groups, and then we have to, of course, remove all the harmful associations with that. Let me show you how Shankaracharya explained these four groups, varnas. So guna, karma, vibhagashaha. The gunas, of course, are sattva, rajas, and tamas, where sattva is a principle of purity, rajas is a principle of activity and passion, and tamas is a principle of ignorance and lethargy. These terms are very well known to you, I'm sure. So, and then associated with each of these gunas are karmas. That is, a sattvika person will act in a sattvic manner. A rajasika person will act in a rajasika manner. That is, they'll be driven by desire and passion, etc. And a tamasika person will behave in a tamasa fashion, that is, with lethargy and ignorance, etc. So this is guna and karma. Guna karma vibhagashaha, he says, according to divisions. What kind of divisions? Suppose we look at each of the four. Brahmana, the priestly caste and caste of priests and teachers. Kshatriya, warriors, politicians, leaders. Vaishya, were merchants. Farmers were included in Vaishya. So farmers and merchants, traders, etc. Shudra, workers. Workers like someone working for a salary. Because Vaishya would refer to the owner of the business or the farm. So, someone who worked for a salary, Shudra. All right. Now, Shankaracharya's analysis of this in terms of the gunas. It goes on for a long paragraph, and I'll spare you all the Sanskrit. But Shankara here talks about one of the gunas being pradhana, prevalent, and the other gunas being not prevalent. So according to which quality is prevalent in a person, that would determine the person's varna. And Shankara then goes on to say that a person for which, let's say we're going to prevalent and secondary. And you see what I mean in just a moment. For a person for whom sattva guna is prevalent and rajoguna is secondary, a person who has these qualities are considered brahmanas. People who are primarily sattvika and have some rajasa. There's no person who's completely free of anyone. So we'd even say there'd even be a tertiary, there'd even be a little bit of tamas here, but we'll presume it's insignificant. But really speaking, we are all, the term used in Vedanta, trigunatmika, we are all combinations of all three. So a person for whom sattva is predominant and rajas is secondary, such a person, guna karma vibhagashaha, according to their qualities and behavior, such a person is a brahmana, not a person who is born to brahmana parents. Got it? Then, who is a kshatriya, according to Shankara, someone who has rajas as their primary quality and has sattva being secondary, such a person is a kshatriya. So the warriors and politicians are very active, but they're active driven by good qualities. So their activity is moderated, as it were, by the purity of sattva. Leading us to vaishyas, merchants, farmers, who also have rajas primary, but tamas secondary. Because whereas the kshatriyas are active for the sake of mankind, vaishyas are active for their own selfish reasons. So they both share this principle of activity, but whereas the kshatriyas are active for the sake of mankind, society, the vaishyas are active for their sakes of themselves and their families. Again, these are definitions according to their qualities and behavior, not according to their families. And finally, the Shudra is one who has tamas prevalent, predominant, and has then rajas as a secondary attribute. So Shudra being overpowered by ignorance and lethargy, someone who doesn't have a vision of life, doesn't have motivation to do anything much, someone who is, I don't know, lazy or uninspired or whatever. Such people, again, guna karma vibhagashaha, according to their qualities and the behaviors born of their qualities, not according to birth. Sri Krishna does not say according to birth. He says according to qualities and actions. And Shankara, in his commentary, makes it even more clear that it has nothing to do with birth. What a what a tragedy it is in Hindu culture that this Varna system has been so badly distorted, perverted, for very incorrect reasons, and has caused such harm, such damage to the culture, to so many people. Okay, when we meet next time, we're going to come back to the main theme. Remember, this is an aside. It just happened to come in the first half of this verse. But when we come back next week, we're going to go back to this jnana karma sannyasa, this idea of being an agent of action at one level and not being an agent of action at another level. We'll continue with that discussion in our next class. I have several important announcements for today. I just mentioned satsang tomorrow. Every Sunday at 6 p.m. we have satsang. We often begin with a small topic. We'll begin with the topic of meditation. And what I'm hoping is to give you an opportunity to ask questions about meditation. We can talk about other things as well. But if we can, we'll try to focus on meditation in tomorrow's satsang. Then I was very happy for me to remind you that our fall classes are restarting. You know that we reduce our teaching schedule every summer, and then in fall we resume with our full schedule. So I'll mention that a week from tomorrow, our children's classes will resume. So if you know of a family with young children, please let them know. Our children's classes is resuming. The children's classes are on the first and third Sunday of each month at 11 a.m. Teen classes will also resume a week later. Then a week from Tuesday, we're resuming our Vedanta class. On Tuesday evenings at 7:30, we usually have a Vedanta class. It's off over the summer, as I mentioned. But we're going to resume a week from Tuesday, and our text will be Katha Upanishad, a very, very important Upanishad. So we'll begin that study a week from Tuesday. And then we have a Sanskrit class. Last year it was a beginning Sanskrit class. It's continuing, so it's now going to be an intermediate Sanskrit class. It will meet on Thursdays, starting a week from Thursday. It'll meet on Thursdays at 7:30 p.m. Intermediate means you're all welcome to come, but if you don't know sandhi and vibhakti, you won't have any idea what's going on. So, if you have already studied some Sanskrit, either here or elsewhere, enough that you understand the basics of sandhi, vibhakti, and a little bit about formation of verbs, if you understand that much, you'll be able to join us. And finally, the following Sunday, which means, no, Saturday, not this coming Saturday, 2 weeks from today, we'll be celebrating Ganesh Chaturthi. We've shifted the celebration to the weekend to make it more convenient for everyone. So our celebration of Ganesh Chaturthi will be 2 weeks from today, which means instead of our normal programs, we'll have a celebration. Our usual celebration will start with some puja, include some chanting, bhajan perhaps, and then I'll have a nice discourse for the event. Instead of ending with a meal, we're going to end with light prasad instead, and you can sign up to bring some kshira, I think they've organized. So that's 2 weeks from today. Instead of our normal classes, we'll have Ganesh. By the way, all of the stuff is on the newsletter. If you haven't gotten a newsletter, get a copy. They're over on the board. It's also on our website, so you can get all that information. Also, finally, the library will be open after class, and we'll conclude with our prayers.